Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, ensuring the voices of Californians are heard in Californians' decisions about healthcare. On the web at chcf.org/voices.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Today on our show, in honor of Veterans Day, we meet a military couple married for 70 years. They say love and a sense of humor are getting them through the pandemic. Plus, we take a look back at the 2020 election, starting with Prop 25, a referendum on whether to ban cash bail. Our colleague at CAP Radio, Scott Rodd, breaks down how the measure failed and what lies ahead for the industry.
The California bail bondsman lives to see another day.
Temporarily, we're feeling pretty good.
Topo Padilla is president of the Golden State Bail Agents Association and owns a bail bond shop in downtown Sacramento.
The voters of California understood that eliminating a person's constitutional right to bail themselves out of jail was not a good thing to get rid of.
His father started the family business in 1979. That 40-year run would have ended if voters hadn't stepped in.
They saw that the fact that a judge would have the sole decision on releasing somebody from jail was not going to work.
Proposition 25 was the only referendum on the general election ballot. It asked voters to uphold or overturn legislation passed 2 years ago that would have ended cash bail. In its place, judges would have assessed a criminal defendant's risk of showing up for trial when deciding whether to release them. Judges would rely in part on an algorithm to evaluate a defendant's risk. Alicia Varani is a criminal justice researcher at UCLA. She says that created some controversy because data used for the algorithm could be biased to begin with.
If we're inputting past arrests into an algorithm and we know that law enforcement targets certain communities, then really it's only going to be a reflection of police behavior and not actual behavior of the individual.
Varani says this resulted in some strange bedfellows opposing Proposition 25. Prosecutors and the bail industry found themselves fighting alongside some civil liberty groups. John Raefling is a senior researcher with Human Rights Watch, which opposed the measure. He argues that the pretrial risk assessments would have continued to unfairly jail criminal defendants before trial.
The big, big issue with it is that people who are held in custody while waiting to resolve their case plead guilty quickly. It contributes to the efficiency of the prosecution and conviction-creating machine.
Raefling argues that this pressure to plead guilty reinforces disproportionate incarceration of Black and brown people. But the man who started the whole debate says Proposition 25 was a missed opportunity to make strides towards a more just system.
Getting a law passed in the way we passed it, in my judgment, was the best we could do.
Senator Bob Hertzberg authored the legislation to ban cash bail, which the industry immediately challenged, leading to Prop 25.
I wanted to win. I'm not feeling good. It's been a 5-year fight. We have a bail industry that basically, in order to stay alive, writes a check, puts it on the ballot, and then it becomes this disinformation campaign.
Still, Hertzberg believes there's opportunity for the legislature to chip away at cash bail in California, but acknowledges there may be some hesitation after voters voiced opposition. If lawmakers don't take action, reform could come from the courts. All eyes are on a petition pending before the state Supreme Court that argues judges should consider a defendant's ability to pay before requiring bail. In Sacramento, I'm Scott Rodd.
You're listening to Valley Edition. 42 states in the U.S. have affirmative action laws in place, but California voters recently rejected the idea for a second time with the defeat of Proposition 16. To find out what this means for public colleges and universities, I spoke with Danya Matos, Associate Chancellor and Chief Diversity Officer at UC Merced, Andrea Venezia, Professor of Public Policy and Administration and Executive Director of the Education Insights Center at Sacramento State, and Alicia Smith Arriaga, Executive Director of the Education Trust West.
Alicia, I'd like to start with you. Proposition 209 banned affirmative action in California more than two decades ago. So we have a sense of what higher education looks like with affirmative action and without it. So can you give us a sense of what impact that ban had, particularly on public higher education institutions in the state of California?
Sure. So this fall, the Education Trust West and a team of researchers from San Diego State University, from USC and UCLA released a report called The Opportunity for Race-Conscious Policy in a More Equitable California. And the researchers found that Prop 209 and the ban on affirmative action adversely impacted California's community colleges. And that ban hampered colleges' efforts to address inequities based on race, to being able to retain students, bolster degree completion, and it really limited the use of race-conscious practices as well. And, you know, there are a lot of impacts that are also on educators and leaders to really honestly discuss race, because there's a lot of rhetoric around Prop 209 and a lot of ambiguity, and people are unclear about the ways that they can use race even in the absence of affirmative action as well.
Andrea, I'd love for you to jump in here, and maybe you could talk a little bit about the data, which is somewhat confusing. And I think when we're talking about Proposition 16, both sides of the, people for Prop 16 and people against Prop 16 were using enrollment data to justify their cause. Could you just talk a little bit about enrollment?
Yeah. So, and I want to give a hat tip to EdTrust West for doing a lot of this work and others. So I'm going to be talking about some data that came from EdTrust West, has been in EdSource and other places. But it's really clear that we are not keeping pace with the racial diversity of high school graduates when it comes to enrollment in our public institutions, and that Prop 209 has created a gap in opportunities for historically minoritized students of color. So when we look at, say, Black student enrollment in the CSU and the UC, it remains lower than the share of high school student graduates in California. And the gap is greater at the CSU, where Black students were 8% of the freshman class in 1997, but have fallen in half to about 4%. And at the same time, the number of Black high school graduates has increased from about 21,000 in 1997 to about 25,000 in 2018. So we know the number of Native Americans entering CSU campuses was really small in 1996, and yet it still fell drastically to 0.2% of the 2018 incoming first-year class, which was about 114 students. In terms of Latinx enrollments in 2018 at the CSU, those closely resemble their share of the high school graduating class. But at the UC, Latinx students are vastly underrepresented, and the widest enrollment gap exists among Latinx at the University of California, where there's a double-digit difference between the percentage of high school graduates and those enrolled in the 2019 first-year class, 52% in high school graduates versus 29% of the entering class of 2019. So these differences between the percentage of students in the high school class compared to the percentage of students in the entering classes is a critical comparison when understanding impact.
So Dania Matos, you're the Chief Diversity Officer at UC Merced, which is known to be one of the most diverse campuses in the UC system. And that's become a real selling point for the university. Just tell us a little bit more about the student population at UC Merced and why diversity is so important from a student perspective.
Yes, absolutely. I also kind of want to couch a little bit in the data analysis cited by my fellow panelists. I think that when you look at UC Merced and what we pride ourselves on is really thinking about the model of equity, justice, and inclusive excellence, right? So really looking at the asset model of what our students bring to the table, right? When you talk about the actual data, right, it's 71% Latinx, an equally high percentage of first-generation students. So really speaking to not only taking in the students, but taking in their families, right? And that's something really special in how we approach our work of student success and retention and really evaluating that. I think it's different to talk about only entering students of color, and we've often used the label diversity to blanket that. But we are very specific and intentional on the outcomes we want to see, and recognizing that each person's contribution in that scope really contributes to that inclusive excellence, right? We were talking about the research, and the UC equally has done some really great literature review on this, but thinking about how the ban on Prop 209 not only impacted STEM persistence, but also the labor market, right? So we were really intentional about recognizing that this ban also had impacts on those earning over $100,000 for African Americans and the Hispanic Latinx Californians, right? So recognizing that there is this valuation also placed on the business case for diversity, and really wanting our students to persist and rise in that inclusive excellence model.
So I'm glad you brought up the workforce, because I think that's an important part of this conversation. Andrea, I'm going to come back to you, Executive Director of Education Insights Center at Sac State. I know you've been doing a lot of thinking about affirmative action as it pertains to hiring practices, particularly in public higher ed. What are your thoughts around how affirmative action has affected that piece of the puzzle?
Yeah, our faculty ranks, and particularly tenured faculty ranks, are very white. And we really must diversify faculty and staff and really work on our hiring practices and our retention practices, and really get to the heart of our campus climate and the love and care we show for our students, and students seeing themselves in us and in what we teach and in how we teach. And that's a critical part, I think, of being able to attract and retain students of color who've been historically minoritized in our systems. And staff are often the frontline workers, and we rarely have opportunities to talk about the role that staff play in recruiting students and in helping students feel loved by our institutions and stay in our institutions. So that's a very critical piece.
Alicia Smith-Ariaga, Executive Director of the Education Trust West, I'm sure you have thoughts about this piece of it as well.
Yes. You know, there's so much work to be done just in terms of diversifying not only faculty at higher ed institutions, but also diversity among the student population as well. We've actually been on the higher ed side looking at programs that are preparing K-12 teachers, which are a critical pipeline to, you know, then ensuring that faculty is also diverse. And in that research, we found that while over 75% of California students are students of color, only 35% of teachers are teachers of color. And so we know from research that students of color do better academically, socially, and emotionally when they have a teacher who looks like them, and that those results, you know, are similar in higher ed. And so we're, you know, we're really recommending that colleges build partnerships with middle schools and high schools across communities so that we can, even in the absence of affirmative action, really work to continue to diversify our educator workforce in both K-12 and in higher ed.
And maybe you could continue and say a bit more about some of the recommendations that you have from a policy perspective on how to address this issue without affirmative action.
Sure. So one of the things that has been, you know, a big source of conversation in the state for the last year is, for instance, Cal State is working right now to, they're examining a policy that would make adding an additional year of math or additional year of quantitative reasoning a requirement for entrance. And, you know, right now that's set to be implemented in 2025 if they're able to find that it won't have disproportionate impact on low-income students and students of color. But you know, from our perspective, when we heard about this and conducted a study, actually had the Research Triangle Institute conduct a study, they found that anywhere from 15 to 20% of Black and Latinx students, if this requirement is currently put into place, would no longer be admitted into CSU. And so, you know, we would argue, especially given COVID-19 and all the work we have to do in K-12, that we need to really be making sure that policymakers and educators are focusing on building and expanding pathways into college and not restricting them. And so that's one policy that we'll definitely be watching closely over the next few years, in addition to making sure that the teacher prep programs are also working to prepare more math teachers, more teachers of color, so that students have access to high quality instruction in math and other subjects where we have huge teacher shortages in the state as well.
So again, this is Andrea. I agree with what my colleague, Dr. Smith-Ariaga, just said. And I think another policy area to focus on potentially when we're coming out of these three pandemics is cluster hiring and hiring, which is hiring multiple scholars into one or more departments based on shared research interests. And that appears to be a great strategy to advance faculty diversity and enhance university and college missions and also improve teaching and community engagement. So that appears to be a promising strategy to diversify faculty in significant numbers and also provide supports for faculty coming in to improve faculty retention.
So, Dania Matos, we're obviously in the middle of a pandemic. UC Merced, like other colleges, has had to shift to a lot of distance education. Can you speak to the extent that the digital divide may disproportionately impact students of color and play a role in this diversity conversation around higher education?
Absolutely. I think that, we really need to recognize that in order to work effectively to dismantle the digital divide, we also need to recognize it as one of the symptoms of larger forms of oppression, power, and privilege. So in particular, the racial digital divide is obviously a symptom of systemic racism, right? So any attempts to solve it just by adding computers or internet access to classrooms or public spaces really needs to go to the dismantling of it and really include different dimensions of it. Gaps in physical access, gaps in pedagogical access, but also gaps in cultural access. So for us, it's really recognizing that, one of our professor Troutsen has done excellent work on this, talking about segregation by design. So the reason that we're seeing it in particularly exacerbated or uncovered by COVID-19 is because it began far sooner than that, right? Classrooms where there's 50% more students of color, they're less likely to have had internet access. They're also less likely to have adaptive software or software for students with disabilities. Students as well, where there's higher students of color enrollment, they're less likely to have participated in the creation of the website and access to things like that. So as we're thinking about it, we're also thinking about not just providing Wi-Fi hotspots or things like that, but really addressing the K-12 aspects that our students came from and recognizing it in the larger framework of systemic racism, that it's not just about computers and internet, but it's about addressing the system as a whole and the inequalities.
So I'm going to go ahead and direct the next question to Alicia Smith-Ariaga, Executive Director of the Education Trust West. Looking forward, what needs to happen to expand access to public universities and then also retention, right? It's not just getting students in the door, it's keeping them there and ensuring that they're successful. So I know that you have been very explicit about some recommendations, and I'd like for you to elaborate more about what you'd like to see happen.
Sure. So, there are a couple of ways that we can really expand access to higher education. And we have some crucial decisions actually to make as a state that will have huge impacts on higher ed this year in terms of the budget. So we know, that we're in a tight economic place, but it's going to be more important than ever this year to invest not only in higher ed, but in K-12 education to ensure that we don't have any gaps that arise due to COVID. And so really making sure financially that we provide resources to both K-12 and higher ed is going to be extremely important. Second, we're really going to have to get really sharp about how we're focusing on areas that were problems before COVID. So, for instance, in California, before COVID, about 80% of Black and Latinx students were not meeting math standards. And now that's not due to any the fact that the students are perfectly capable of doing math. However, we face a huge shortage in the state of math teachers, and we have a lot of work to do in terms of actually making sure that we're using curriculum across the state that reflects a lot of the rigor that is needed to be able to access college. And so making sure that we have equitable access across the state to AP courses, to rigorous math classes, that we're accelerating students even in the midst of COVID in math, is going to be critical
to ensuring that they have access to future college opportunities as well. And then finally, really working right now to diversify our educator pipeline in K-12 and to diversify faculty in higher ed is going to be key in ensuring that we're able to retain students when they get to higher ed institutions. Making sure that campuses are actually reflective of the diversity of California is going to be key. And, you know, we have a lot of progressive rhetoric in California about how we believe in getting rid of systemic racism and really rooting out racism, but we have to make sure that our action starts to match what our rhetoric is.
One of the things that I think is so interesting and so baffling when it comes to education reform is that it doesn't happen in silos. It has to happen across systems. And Andrea, I'd love for you to sort of have the last word here. You know, as Executive Director of Education Insights Center, you are looking at education reform in a really inclusive way. And can you just speak to the complexity of the work when it involves, you know, from the moment students first enter into the education system all the way to the point at which they enter into the workforce, and how you get all of these different entities along the way to work collaboratively to address these problems of diversity and inequality in education?
It's an excellent question. And I think, and my colleagues have spoken to this so eloquently leading that. So I think what I would add is that I really hope that the state can create an entity that can hold that space. Right now, we organize our education systems in ways that make sense to the people who sit within them often and not for our students. And we lose our students every time we have a gap between systems, every time we don't hold them with love and care across our systems, we lose them. And we are replicating oppression and racism throughout K-12 and higher education. We have to interrogate those structures within and across systems. And there are similarities that we know around how we assess and how we track in different classes, class levels, and the access we create with our curriculum. And what happens within the classroom in terms of the pedagogies and the curriculum that are used and the disproportionate impact we create. So looking at those similar issues that affect our students across our systems repeatedly, and it's beyond time that the state have goals and data and authority to be able to track our successes and where we're falling short. In all of these areas. And that's what I hope we can see after COVID to ensure that we never go back to where we were.
And just to be clear, there is no way from a data perspective to track a student all the way through their educational process. Is that correct?
Not yet. There is a lot of work happening right now to create a statewide longitudinal data system. And hopefully that will happen. You know, we see that we've been in crisis for so long in this state that it could have helped with COVID, but it can help with all these crises that we are still dealing with as we move forward out of COVID.
Well, big thank you to all of you for the work that you're doing to address equity issues in education and for just informing us about the work today. So Alicia Smith-Ariaga, Executive Director of the Education Trust West, Andrea Venezia, Executive Director of Education Insight Center at Sac State, and Danya Matos, Associate Chancellor and Chief Diversity Officer at UC Merced. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Valley Edition. We'll be back with more stories after the break.
If 2020 has taught us anything, it's that having a trusted source for news is more important now than ever. Every day, Valley Public Radio brings you the news and information you need to stay informed and goes beyond the headlines to bring you stories with depth and meaning. It's radio for the relentlessly curious. Whatever happens in the next few months, you can count on NPR and FM 89 to bring you the facts and real insight so you can have a better grasp on what's happening in your community and your world. But in order to do that, we need your help. Your monthly sustaining membership will help us stay on the story and bring you the news you need wherever events take us. Your donation is an investment in our community and your ability to stay informed. Become a sustaining member today at kvpr.org.
You're listening to Valley Edition. Staying with the elections, misinformation continues to spread well after Americans cast their ballots last Tuesday. This includes some false claims about California's election. Here to set the record straight is our colleague from CAP Radio, PolitiFact California reporter Chris Nichols. He talks to CAP Radio's Ed Fletcher in a segment called Can You Handle the Truth?
Chris, President Trump shared a misleading video on Twitter yesterday. It called into question ballot collection in Los Angeles. What can you tell us about this?
This video shows LA County election workers legally collecting ballots from an authorized drop box the day after Election Day. A woman approaches them and is suspicious of what they're doing. Here's what she says.
I thought they collected them all. I just want a document.
No, we're still collecting.
How much? Wait, but how come they already called the state?
Because these are mail-in ballots.
What did the LA County Register say about this video?
Well, the registrar's office confirmed to PolitiFact last week when this video started circulating, originally on TikTok, that all drop boxes were closed and locked at 8 p.m. on election night. The registrar also confirmed that ballots were, again, legally picked up the next day for processing.
Did the president say anything else when he shared this video?
Well, he added a quote saying, "You are looking at ballots." And then he asked, "Is this what our country has come to?" And the answer is, he's right. These are ballots. They're legal ballots being collected by authorized election officials. And when the video first circulated last week, it had a headline about cheating in California, and PolitiFact rated that false. There's nothing illegal happening here. With Trump sharing it yesterday, we rated that false again, and Twitter also added a warning label at the bottom of the president's tweet.
Chris, you also checked out some claims this week about voter fraud in Nevada's presidential election. What's being said and what are the facts?
Well, last week, President Trump's campaign and Nevada Republicans claimed that thousands of people who moved out of Nevada still voted there in the election. And the problem is that when they published a list of these people who supposedly cast fraudulent votes, they included members of the military deployed overseas, plus students from Nevada going to college in another state, and also some people who had moved out of the state within 30 days. And all three of these groups were allowed to vote in Nevada's election. This was not evidence of any widespread fraud, and PolitiFact rated that false.
A conservative election watchdog group made a related allegation, but this time accusing Californians of voting in Nevada's election. What did you find there?
The Election Integrity Project claimed about 1,400 Californians may have unlawfully voted in Nevada's election. They said they submitted their findings to the Nevada Secretary of State's office, but the group did not make those findings public. The group says these are Californians who had moved out of Nevada several months before the election and were not within this 30-day period that's allowed.
What did the Nevada Secretary of State's office have to say about this?
The office would not address this specific claim, but it pledged to thoroughly investigate all credible accusations of voter fraud. And it's important to note that no election officials in Nevada or in any other state have cited any large-scale cases of wrongdoing or fraud in the election. The Nevada office added that many complaints about voter fraud lack evidence and are really complaints about process or policy.
That was CAP Radio's Chris Nichols with Can You Handle the Truth? This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. After many weeks of holding steady, COVID-19 cases are once again on the rise, nationally, statewide, and here in the Valley. Public health officials tally case numbers at the county level, but the circumstances can vary wildly between cities and rural areas. Here this week with a small town perspective is FM89's Carrie Klein with our COVID-19 update. Welcome back, Carrie.
Hi, thanks, Kathleen.
So as usual, let's begin with the virus outlook for the San Joaquin Valley as a whole.
Right. Okay. So if we look at case numbers, there is no ignoring that they are really starting to rise. On average, we're up to about, across the seven counties in our coverage area, up to around 500 people who are testing positive every day. And that is the highest number since early September. If we look at hospitals, hospitalizations and COVID-related patients in the ICU, those have all risen pretty steadily in the last week. We're not seeing more deaths just yet. There's still around 30 people dying every week, but there is typically a lag. So, as the case numbers rise, eventually that rise, we will start to see that in the fatalities as well, most likely anyway. If we look at the blueprint for a safer economy, this reopening plan statewide, there's some not so good news all around. Madera and Tulare counties are still stuck in purple, the most restrictive tier. All other counties in our area are at risk of retreating backward. So that means Fresno, Merced, Kern, and Kings counties are in danger of moving from red to purple. Mariposa from yellow to orange. And retreating would involve bringing back some restrictions on businesses that we thought we had crawled our way out of in the last couple of months. And all of that could happen as early as next Tuesday, depending on the numbers. And in Fresno County, at least, health officials are pretty certain that that retreat will happen. I also think it's important to note that what's happening here is happening all over the state. So this week, 11 counties fell back a tier, and another 31 are in danger of doing it next Tuesday, including those here in the Valley. Earlier this week, California Health and Human Services Secretary Mark Galli had a pretty sobering press conference, and he really spent a lot of time warning us against COVID fatigue, and he said, the virus does not go away just because we're tired of it. And I think that's something that a lot of people everywhere are saying, obviously, as we get into the holiday season. Galli showed us some useful charts. He showed that cases really dropped when businesses closed back up at the end of the summer, and they're rising again as businesses open. That doesn't necessarily mean that these openings cause that rise in cases, but that when we hear that businesses can be open, it might mean that we let our guard down a little bit more and we're more reckless in general, and not just, going to those businesses and spreading the disease there.
So when we talk about local case rates, where are those numbers the highest? Are they evenly spread out across the valley?
No, they're not, unfortunately. And I should point out that we only have detailed geographic data for a few counties in this area, namely Fresno, Kern, Tulare, and Merced counties down at the zip code or the city level. And an important data point to look at here is not just the total number of cases in a community, but the number of cases per capita. It's what's known as the case rate or the case density. And in those four counties, it's not the biggest cities that have the highest case density, but often the smaller, more rural communities, many of which are unincorporated.
That's so interesting. Why are the case rates in those communities so high?
I don't think that there's just one reason. Because so many communities are so different. But if we zoom out to kind of the county level, health officials are blaming a few things. Generally, it's person-to-person contact with close contacts, like family and friends. There are big gatherings. We, of course, saw this a little bit this past week. There was an election party where Fresno Mayor-elect Jerry Dyer and County Supervisor Steve Brandau were infected. Now dozens of people have been quarantined as a precaution. In Fresno, that's not really all that many people, but it would be a huge proportion of a tiny community. And in many of these small communities, a big reason for the spread of the virus, not surprisingly, is the workplaces. Take Parlier. It's a city of 15,000 people in Fresno County. There, the case rate is about twice the average in Fresno County. I spoke about it with Mayor Alma Beltran, who says the virus is widespread enough and the city is small enough that everyone knows someone who's been affected. Her son actually caught the virus.
It wasn't too hard on him. He did deal with some symptoms that were, with the headaches and losing the taste and the smell. The other thing, I have a close friend that I've known for over 30 years who passed away from COVID. So it does scare us in a sense, because it's when it hits close to home, you start to really think about, oh my gosh, this is something that can get really scary.
From what she can tell, Beltran says Parlier residents are following the rules. Recently, there haven't been any huge gatherings or parties. But what she says is that there are so many essential workers in Parlier.
The stories that I've heard so far has been work-related. It has been because they have to go to work and they are essential workers. you know, like just this example with my son, you know, he got it from work. He wore his mask. He did everything that they were asked to do.
So many of those people are in agriculture, meat packing plants, warehouses. And so she feels like her hands are tied. She doesn't want more people to lose their livelihoods.
You know, when I think about COVID-19 in the workplace, one place that I think about here locally is the Foster Farms plant in Livingston, where there was an enormous outbreak.
Yes, absolutely. You know, that occurred earlier this summer. You know, Livingston and Merced County is in a similar position to Parlier. It's almost the same size, around 14,000 people. And the case rate there is also right around twice the county average. It's also the highest case rate in the county, but in Merced County, at least. But there, 400 cases, or around 40% or more of the entire caseload in Livingston, can be traced back to that one poultry plant outbreak. Here's Livingston Mayor Gurpal Samra.
We did have a higher rate, but that was for that period of time with the Foster Farms outbreak. Since then, we are in line with other cities.
Like Parlier, Samra says his community is tight-knit, and it's been hard to see so many community members falling ill. And although things have settled after Foster Farms contained its outbreak, cases have been ticking up again recently, just like in the rest of the county and country, really.
People are just burned out with COVID precaution. They're just tired of it. They don't know. You know, they just want to do something. You know, I think that's what it is, the fatigue of it at this point.
So at the end of the day, what can small towns like these do to contain the virus?
Well, both these mayors say that they are looking to the county to provide guidance and to pass down the rules, you know, that come down from the governor. You know, they're both sending mailers to the residents in multiple languages, hoping that residents stay alert and, you know, just kind of doing outreach in that way. And in Parlier, like many other cities, you know, they've gotten federal funding to provide assistance with rent, mortgage, and utility payments for those residents who are struggling.
Certainly a welcome support in those communities. So, Carrie, thank you for the update.
Yeah, thank you, Kathleen.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. A 2019 documentary that was directed and produced by UC Merced Global Arts Professor Yehuda Shireem will be screened internationally over the next few weeks. The film, titled Songs That Never End, explores the displacement and struggle of new refugees through the eyes of two young siblings who immigrated to Houston from Iran with their family. I spoke to Shireem about the project, and he started our conversation by sharing the story of the family featured in the film.
The Dayan family, the film focuses on the Dayan family. I met them just a day after the current administration came to power. That was the first week in Houston. In many ways, they are the last, almost the last refugees that were able to enter this country from Iran. Let me tell you a bit about the family. Abbas, the father, worked as an oil engineer for many years. Then one day he discovered that the Iranian government is using him in order to purchase nuclear weapons. So he immediately demonstrated and got very angry and spoke against the government and said, instead of buying weapons, we need to help our people who are hungry. Obviously, his comments were taken very seriously, and the Secret Service, the Iranian police, was after him. He received a phone call from his secretary, and the secretary told him, you better leave the country because they just came to the office, the police, and you better leave. The family had two homes, a number of cars, drivers, but they had half an hour to pack everything, not even saying goodbye, not even able to take any kind of money with them or property or anything. Back then they had two kids, Ali, who was 6, and Hana, who was 3 or around that age, and the wife, Abbas's wife, Samira, who worked at the local school as a history teacher. They packed everything and drove and left everything and drove to the Iran-Iraq border. They reached Iraq and stayed there for a year, living in different hotels. Again, unable to access any kind of bank accounts or even to sell their old homes. Everything was taken by the government. I remember when Samira, during the film, she talks about that drive. She talks about crying nonstop. Hannah, the young daughter, recalls the sobbing, the sound of tears, the sound of agony, that trauma where you are forced to leave. After 1 year in Iraq, the family moves to Turkey with the hope that they will be able to move to Europe. They even paid for smugglers who didn't really help, just took the money and then left them. They 3 years lived in Turkey as undocumented, they didn't have any papers, like most Iranian refugees who arrived to Turkey. During that time, Ali went to school, Hannah went to school. The family lived in one bedroom, all four of them. Ali was bullied in school, and not only by his peers, but also by his teachers. So he decided to stop going to school. So over the next 2 years and a half, he just stayed at home with his mother. The same happened to Hannah. So she, just like her brother, stayed with the mother in old days, and you hear about it in the film, they just pray. The mother during that time, Samira, lost sense of hope, meaning she began to be really, really depressed, stopped cooking, stopped taking care of the room, of the house. And Abbas was working for 16, 18 hours a day for less than a minimum wage, just like most immigrants who do not have papers and are being exploited. After 3 years in such a condition, and during which Samira also gave birth for another two young children, twins, Ilya and Helia, that you will see all of them in the film, the family arrived to the US. They arrived to the US just as Trump came to power, and they meet me in a local clinic where I was filming my previous film, and they begin speaking Farsi with me and ask me, what is going to happen to us? Is this our home? Did we find safety here? Is there such thing as safety? What will happen to us? What will happen with America? That is how our encounter developed. I didn't know Farsi then. I'm a son of Iranian immigrant refugees who arrived to Israel in the 50s, but they were so too ashamed to speak Farsi, so I don't speak that language, but I was able to immediately connect with the family, and then we began talking, and that's how the film started.
So I have to interrupt and ask, that question that they asked you is so compelling. How did you respond? Do you think it is possible for refugees to find safety here?
Beautiful question, and somewhat extremely timely. I think that question applies to all of us. Not only to refugees. Are we able to find safety here in this country? In this country that insists on freedom and liberty, or so it seems. Last month, when I talked with Abbas and we tried to talk about the experience of the last 4 years, we talked about how everything got actually much worse. And because refugees and immigrants who come here and don't have any other option but leave their home and reimagine a new home, come here with the hope that America, this country, will offer them some kind of refuge, a human refuge. They don't necessarily find it. And we don't necessarily even hear about it in the news. Most refugees find jobs that are less than $10 an hour. Abbas he lost his job over the last 6 months. But for the children, Hannah doesn't see herself but being an American. Ali, as you will see during the film, constantly struggles with his Iranian Persian identity, constantly wants to stop speaking Farsi at home and insist on only speaking English, stop listening to Daryush or Gugush and begin listening to J-Lo and Pitbull. Mm-hmm. And instead of eating gourmet sabzi, let's go eat McDonald's. So there's constant struggle, particularly for the young in the family, Ali and Hannah, and they are constantly debating. For Abbas and Samira, it's a totally different challenge because they're away from what they identify as home. And there's always a big challenge in reimagining yourself, recreating oneself.
So the name of the film is Songs That Never End. Tell me about that title and what it speaks to.
So the filming was around 2.5-3 years. And every day when I filmed, usually like 10 hours a day, the day ends with Samira and Abbas sitting around the kitchen table, pouring me tea and encouraging me to listen to Iranian music. Iranian music, musicians like Dariush, Gugush, Feridun Forahi, they all talk about a land, a country that was taken away from its people. They all talk about that tragedy. They all talk about longing and craving for freedom and liberty. And those songs that we end every day, almost every other day of filming with those songs, for me, are the songs of defiance, songs that talk about our craving, the craving of the soul, the songs of the soul for freedom, for safety, for solidarity, for compassion, while at the same time looking at so much horror and terror that we are all encountering, not only in Iran, but some will say even here.
Well, before we wrap up, how can people watch the film?
So the film will be screened this Friday at 7 p.m. through the Center for the Humanities at UC Merced. It will be a virtual screening. So, and then a Q&A with myself, producer, and some other scholars. And then the film will go into Mainz, Germany, and it will be available for 5 days again, virtual screening. And from there, it will go to Berlin. So, and then from there, it will go to Athens and then back to Germany. So there are multiple options. And now that you're at home and you are, addicted to either to the news or Netflix or both, that could be another way of engaging with what really is a different aspect of our lives that we are not necessarily seeing through, media right now in the U.S.
Yehuda Sharim, filmmaker of Songs That Never End. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Kevin.
And finally, Wednesday was Veterans Day. In honor of the holiday, FM89's news director Alice Daniels spoke with a couple who live at the Fresno Veterans Home and have been married for 70 years. They've had their share of challenges during the pandemic, including living apart for 3 months. But as you'll hear in this audio postcard, they've gotten by with love and a sense of humor.
Okay, my name is Edward Pastana.
My name is Peggy Pastana.
Our first date was to San Francisco's Playland, which is gone now. And so anyway, in later years, she told me the very first ride we got there, we were going to take a ride through the Tunnel of Love. And she said, oh, no. And I didn't do anything. I just talked about the things in the place, and we laughed about these things trying to scare you as they come out and all this stuff. And she said, after that, she thought that was a good idea.
I'm still in love. Still a good guy.
I served 22 years in the service in the Air Force.
I used to call myself the B crew. I'll be here when you leave, and I'll be here when you come back. I had a pretty bad accident in March. I caught my toe on the sidewalk going into a restaurant here in Fresno, and I went full force ahead and hit my head in their rock foundation, broke my knee, broke my wrist, and the worst part, broke my neck.
Oh, it was terrible. I couldn't talk to her directly, so I'd go over to her window, and I could see her, and she could see me, so we'd talk on the telephone.
Well, the nurses started calling him Romeo because he was outside the window, talking on his phone through the glass. And so they called us Romeo and Juliet because he would come, a couple times a day over there and we'd chit-chat.
Yeah, they said, here comes Romeo again. And I got that nickname, I guess. There wasn't I didn't have a balcony to climb up to, but I could talk to her. Luckily, she's on the ground floor. Everything's on the ground floor here.
He's kind, and he has a sense of humor, and we laugh a lot, and that I think that's important. We have to keep laughing.
Yeah, we laugh a lot. That's true.
Well, I look pretty funny, you know, with a brace on my leg and a brace on my arm and a neck brace, and that was lots to laugh about if you really looked yourself in the mirror. So, and my hair was getting longer and longer, and one nice thing was when we came back here, it was pretty long in the back. When I came back here to our room, it was pretty long in the back, it looked terrible. So my husband gave me my first haircut, so he took care of me, and it turned out pretty good. So we have 3 sons, and we have 7 grandchildren and 3 great-grandchildren. I really think the hardest part is not being able to see our families. And one thing they do here that's wonderful, they set up Zoom for you. They come in your room and set it all up, because us oldies don't fathom a lot of that.
I think the isolation of it is you don't get out and visit people, and I think that's important for people our age.
The holidays are going to be kind of rough, I think, but we are blessed because we're together, too, and that helps. So we have a lot of memories to share.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Twitter and Facebook. We've got an app. It's called KVPR. The show is produced by our news team, including Alice Daniel, Carrie Klein, Madi Bolaños, and Sarith Hawk. Technical support is from Marv Allen and Don Weaver. I'm your host, Kathleen Schock. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, ensuring the voices of Californians are heard in Californians' decisions about healthcare. On the web at chcf.org/voices.